Hi, everybody. My name is Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I'm grateful to be here this evening. Heck, I'm grateful to be anywhere this evening sober. That's for sure, because that wasn't always the case. I want to certainly thank the committee for asking me to come out and participate.
They'll call you up and they'll say, hey, we're wondering if you would come and give an AA talk.
And you're like, okay. And they tell you where to go and where to fly into, and you do. And then all of a sudden you realize, like, I have no idea where I'm going, who's really meeting me other than their name is John and Kathy. You know, this is that. And in fact, my husband was speaking Canada? And he gets up there to the border, and they said to him, where are you going? He said, I have no idea. He goes, well, who's picking you up? He said, I have no idea. He goes, well, do you even have their last name? He said, no, I have no idea. But fortunately, he had an AA flyer. And he says, I'm going to this. And the guy looked, and he, like, let him go on through, you know. So I'd like to thank John and Kathy for showing up, because there's nothing that feels better than getting off a plane, and you go down some escalator, and all of a sudden you're realizing, I sure hope whoever's supposed to pick us up is there, and they were there alive and well. And we got up this morning at like 3 o'clock LA time, because to get to the airport it takes forever at LA. And then we were at LA for a couple of hours, and then we're on that 5-hour flight, and I said to Patrick, oh, thank goodness we're finally off that plane and we could get up and move. And then they put us in a car for over an hour in bumper to bumper traffic, and then they said, oh, by the way, and I've been traveling and grungy, you've got like 15 minutes to go up and freshen up and change. And then I said, okay, at least, you know, now maybe I can move a little bit. And then they put me in a car for another hour coming down here. So I'm here at great inconvenience. No, I'm kidding. And again, we're grateful to be here. And if you know John and Kathy, they're quite lively people, and we've had a good time already. I want to thank my husband, Patrick, for coming with me. I have 25 years sober, and Patrick has 37, so we have 62 years of drinks undrunk in our home. That makes for quite a bit of a better home life than in the olden days. And, and you're going to hear in my story that I did not drink away a 21-year marriage. I actually sobered away a 21-year marriage, because the same selfishness and self-centeredness that I came into AA with 25 years ago, sadly, I brought well into my recovery, in the name of thinking I was a good AA. You know, and when I was drinking, it was always about me and the courts, me and the police, me and, you know, being in lockdown facilities, me and child services. And then when I became sober, it became about me and my sobriety, me and my meetings, me and my recovery, me and going back to school, me, me, me. And the same husband that I abandoned in drunkenness, I went on to abandon in sobriety. But through the grace of God, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that fourth and fifth step, which does not tell me what my part is. It says, where am I at fault? Where was I to blame? And at 12 years sober, my husband ended up leaving me for another woman, and that's between him and his God. But when I inventoried that, I never, ever made him feel like he was number one. And he really always was in my heart. It just never translated to my actions. And because I was able to take that inventory, when I got in my new relationship with Patrick, I don't have to make those same mistakes. So we have a little kitty at home. It's a little jar, and we throw an extra 20 or 100 bucks in it whenever we can. So when I speak, we use that money to pay for his ticket, and when he speaks, we use that money to pay for mine, and we get to do this deal together. And so I'm honored to have him here with me. And I'm just going to get this out now, because sometimes when you feel emotional about something, you're kind of choking and you're trying to avoid it your whole talk. So I want to let you know that my 90-year-old mom is in hospice, and we got a call 4 days ago. The hospice nurses told me death was imminent and that I was to come, and I was really torn. Obviously, AA can always find another speaker, but my mom's only got me and my sister, and so I wasn't going to come. But I've learned to not make impulsive, you know, knee-jerk decisions, and I did talk to my sponsor, Clancy. And he told me, Tammy, why don't you wait until Thursday night and you'll make a decision. And whatever decision you make Thursday night will be the decision. And I spent the entire last week just with my mom, just me and my mom, laying in bed, holding her. And I had to go speak last night, and I went and spoke, and I still hadn't made a decision. And then at like 11 o'clock at night, Patrick and I went to mom's house, and I was going to make that decision then. And she was laying in bed, and she looked so peaceful. And all she wanted to do was die at home with her cat and her books and her family. And my children went and said goodbye this week. And my sister hadn't had a chance to come down yet. And I looked at my mom in bed, and she didn't open her eyes, but I just said, Mommy, it's Tammy. And she said, Tammy, I love you.
and I'm ready to go now. And she was so peaceful. And then my sister called and said, you know, Tam, I'd like to come down Friday and Saturday and have that alone time with Mom that you and the kids did. And I got my answer. And if the good Lord decides to take my mom at any time this weekend, that smile and the peace in her face and telling her she loves me, like, if that's the last memory I have, I'm good with that. And I didn't know up until that second. And Patrick knew the minute she did that, he kind of looked at me and he knew we were going to go. But I also know that I could have easily called John, and anyone in this room could have stepped up, because that's what we do, right? And so I'm really grateful to be here tonight. And I'm grateful that I was able to be there for that mom whose heart I broke. I do have a home group. It's called the Pacific Group. We're actually the largest weekly meeting in the world. We run about 1,000 a week, so we're kind of like a convention. We have 80 people on our coffee crew alone. The coffee crew shows up at 4 o'clock. The meeting doesn't start until 7:50, and we don't get out of there till about 10:30 at night because we have so many cakes. And we're like a fine-oiled machine, and I'm very, very proud to be a member of my Pacific Group. I do have a sponsor that I'm sure some of you have heard of. I even whispered to John real quick before I got up here. Does everyone here, like, hate Clancy? Just give me a heads up, because I hear a lot of stuff about my sponsor, and 90% of the time people haven't met him. They just heard something. But I have a sponsor named Clancy, and I'm honored that I've been under his tutelage. He's certainly served my family and myself and Alcoholics Anonymous well. And my sponsor's primary purpose, not his secondary, not his tertiary purpose, is from what I've witnessed the entire time I've known him, is his number one purpose in life was, first, he remained sober himself for 59 years. He will be 60 years in August if he makes it, or October. And he dedicated 59 years of that sober life to helping other alcoholics achieve sobriety. So he sets the bar real high. And the book tells us that's what we're supposed to do. It's not, I get sober myself, and then I get a sober life, and I'm got to go to work, and I got to do this, and I got to do that. And hey, man, thanks, AA, for being there for me. But, you know, I'm busy now, right? And he certainly has been the epitome to me of being a faithful, humble servant. I don't know the price you paid for your seat here tonight or for any seat in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am sad to say, and I will never be proud to share, that the price I paid for that seat there tonight, or for any seat in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I laid down my little 5-year-old son and my little 6-year-old daughter. Because a clear liquid called vodka was more powerful than the love a mother had for her own 2 children. And I drank away my 5 and my 6-year-old. And I don't know, we were talking in the car a bit. There's a modicum of speakers lately that are coming out, and they'll have you rolling on the aisles. And I've had people come to me, you know, you look like you were a wild alcoholic. I'm sure this is going to be fun. Patrick recently had some guy walk in and say, ooh, with that Irish brogue, I bet you're going to entertain us tonight. And quite frankly, if you're here to be entertained tonight, and if you're here to be rolling on the floors laughing, I'm probably not going to be your favorite speaker. Because it's not funny to drink away a little boy and a little girl that God blessed me with to love and protect. But through the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to become the mother that those children deserved. And I can't imagine the shame and the guilt and the remorse I would have had. And I've sponsored many women that unfortunately didn't get sober until after their kids' childhoods that they could never get back. And I'm so grateful to those crusty old-timers that cared way more about my actions than they did about my feelings. And I used to feel like the old-timers were so much harder on me than other people. You know, I'd walk in with my little low-cut tops and my Daisy Duke shorts, and they'd make me go home and change. And then Patty over there next to me is like flitting herself around the meeting, and nobody said anything to her. And you know what? I'm so grateful to the old-timers that had the courage to tell me those ugly chunks of truth that they talk about in that 12 and 12 that we have to swallow about ourselves to cross that bridge from drunkenness into sobriety. Young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't respect your old timers, don't worry about it. You're never going to be one. You know? A lot of people come into Alcoholics Anonymous mouth first, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear in my story, for 6 months. I came in and out mouth first, telling y'all what I thought you needed to do to improve Alcoholics Anonymous, until a female judge hit a gavel down and she took custody away from me of my 5 and my 6-year-old. And I said to her, you can't do that. And she said, I can, and I just did. And that was the first time I understood what the meaning of powerless meant. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous with the willingness of the dying that they talk about. And if you told me to dress like Mary Poppins and stay away from the men, yes, sir, because I don't know what price it takes for some of you. And I've sponsored many women that have lost 1, 2, and 3 kids, and it still hasn't got their attention. But that was my bottom. I had my first drink when I was 13, and I've come to understand after reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I didn't understand that at 13. I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. I thought an alcoholic was someone that lived in a cardboard condominium on Skid Row, and I had no idea that I suffered from alcoholism. I'm described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous as an alcoholic that is never mildly intoxicated. I'm always more or less insanely drunk. So I'm like either sober or drunk. There's like no in between for me. So when people talk about, I was partying, I don't know what partying was. In the beginning I drank to have fun, I guess. Very shortly after, I drank just to be normal. And toward the end, I just drank not to feel. So I didn't understand that I drank solely for the effect. I'm also what's described in AA vernacular as a puking blackout drinker. And again, it doesn't spell it out in the book, so I can only share with you my experience with that. But there has never, ever been a time that I drank beverage alcohol from my very first drink that I didn't puke it up. I am that physically, hideously allergic to alcohol. I know this offends some of you long-term drinkers. I hated the taste of alcohol. I could not stand the smell or the taste of alcohol. In fact, toward the end of my drinking, I used to have to plug my nose and uncap that vodka, and then I'd have to down it as quickly as I could and keep my nose plugged, because if I smelled it, I'd start to retch and gag, and I'd puke it up. You're a puker. The pukers are all like, And I just pray that that vodka would stay down long enough to heat up my chest and give me that goofy feeling in my head. And then I'd throw the whole thing up. And usually after the first puke, then you could keep some down after that. And that's how I drank. I actually had summer and winter drinking wear. I had like this plastic Naugahyde shower cap because I used to have this long blonde hair. Because when you're puking, the barf particles bounce off the sink and the toilet water in your hair. But then I actually found a lighter linen one for the summer. And I'm also described as a blackout drinker. And for those people that are new, I can only share with you my experience. But when I drink alcohol, I will have lapses of memory where I will do the most strange and incredible things that, quite frankly, I would be mortified to do in a sober state of mind, only to feel that pitiful and that incomprehensible demoralization they talk about in the book the next day when people would tell me what I had done the night before. And again, I didn't understand any of that because I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. I ran away from home at age 15. To make a real long, complicated story short, our stories disclose in a general way, so I'm not going to go into graphic detail, but I'd been put in 3 foster homes prior to the age of 15 because of the illicit nature of the relationship my father had with my sister and I. To make a long story short, if you were a girl and you had a budding teenage body, you certainly were not safe to live at home with my biological father. So I'd been put in 3 foster homes prior to 15, always with my sister. And this has absolutely nothing to do with my alcoholism. The reason I share about it is because many well-meaning, and I really want to reiterate, many well-meaning healthcare professionals led me to believe it did. I think it took me 5 years in AA to realize my sister went through the exact same childhood, and her life took a completely different path. Went to high school, went to college, got married, got the good job, and I went south. So my childhood had really nothing to do with the allergy that I have to alcohol, but it kept me sick for a really long time because I wore that childhood like a badge of honor. You know what? If you had my childhood, you'd drink like I did too. And unfortunately, many well-meaning healthcare professionals, supported and substantiated those old ideas of mine. I'm a high school English teacher by profession today, and out in LA, I'm not sure if it's the same out here, if you're what we call a system kid, or a kid who's been in foster or guardian care system, every other kid has a manila-colored folder like this, a chart, a student chart. And if you're a system kid, you have an orange one. We call it the pumpkin. So I was a pumpkin kid. I had an orange folder. And that means that once a week you have to meet with your guidance counselor as opposed to once a quarter or once a semester like the typical general education population. So I would be called in with my guidance counselor, and I started to become very evasive about absences I was having, and she noticed I wasn't making eye contact. So she got suspicious, and she sent child services out to our house, and my dad had been removed from that house 6 months earlier. But see, Mom had run out of money, and Dad lurked around, and so Mom took Dad back in, and they found him there, and I faced going into my fourth foster home at 15 years old. But see, my sister had run away from home a year earlier when she was 15, and she was now a 16-year-old runaway. And for the first time, I was going to go into a foster home without my big sister. So I told the guidance counselor after school that day, they were waiting for the police and everybody to come and talk to me. I just asked her if I could use the restroom, and she said yes. And, of course, I ran down the hall, hopped the fence, and I ran away from school and just became a 15-year-old runaway. And I did what 15-year-old runaway girls do, I guess, in order to survive. I certainly didn't prostitute myself in the general sense, but I would just find older men that were willing to take me in. And I was young, I was fun, and I was willing to pay a price that no 15-year-old girl, no girl should ever have to pay. Interestingly, I had that kind of double life they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, because as a kid, there was a lot of like infidelity and instability with my dad and stuff at home. So school was always the safe place for me to land. And school isn't usually a really popular arena for alcoholics because it's a tremendous amount of structure and discipline over a very elongated period of time with little or no gratification till way down the road. And we don't tend to migrate toward those arenas. It's like, I want to feel good yesterday. But for me, school was a safe place to land. And, you know, you can ask my husband, I'm still at my happiest when I'm curled up with a good book in my bedroom with my dogs. I have learned to like the concept of people, and I've learned to certainly love many, many in AA. But I am still a little gun shy with people. I don't kind of jump in with both feet. It takes me a while to acclimate. Don't know why, it doesn't really matter. But when I was a kid, I was an extremely good athlete. And again, I teach high school today, so if you're either decent looking, or you're a good athlete, or you have some type of academic prowess, school's a pretty safe place to land. And for me, I was actually academically inclined. I've always been a good student because I'm a voracious reader, and most tests, at least back then, were based on they were reading-based tests. So I was a phenomenal student. I was a ranked athlete, and I was a decent-looking kid back then, so school was that safe place to land, and home was always about craziness and instability. So I'd come home from school at 9 years old, and they had this big, huge tennis complex across the street from our house, and that was when tennis was really in its heyday. And they'd have these courts just filled every day, and I'd walk over after school, and I'd be the ball girl, and I'd throw the balls to the players, and they'd tip me some quarters. And an old pro ended up becoming in charge of this big sports complex, and he noticed me one day playing tennis with the ball machine and a racket, and he saw that I had some hand-eye coordination, and he started to coach me from the time I was 9 years old until 15. I ended up becoming ranked 23 in the state of California, getting ready to go to the junior pro circuit when I was 16. So the goal in my life was always, I know I live with this crazy family, but I love school, so I'm just going to spend all day in school and then all weekend playing these tennis tournaments and getting rankings. And at 16, I'll be able to leave this nutbag family of mine and go on the junior pro circuit. And I was favored to actually do quite well on the circuit. So that was just kind of always that dream. So at 15, running away from home, that really messed that up because I was playing for my tennis team at school. So that old tennis pro eventually located me and he said, look, Tammy, I have an extra condominium with an extra bedroom. Why don't you move in with me and you could stay with me and I'll go to the courts and I'll face the courts with you and we'll find a safe place for you to live until you're 16 and you could try out for the circuit. So I moved in with him. He was 40. I was 15. For obvious reasons, I was a very precocious, sexualized 15-year-old. Sadly to say, he fell to the temptation and I just ended up becoming his live-in girlfriend at 15. And we never did show up to those court dates and I never did go back to school during that time. He had two children from a previous marriage, and I remember they'd come and visit him, and I was fine because I was on good behavior for prescribed amounts of time, and they would come, and I remember one afternoon he and I got into shooters of tequila. I call it tequila if you're an alcoholic of my type, and I went in a blackout and acted like the crazy person in front of those two little kids, and they went home and told Mom, and then Mom told him, your children will never come see you on the weekends as long as that girl's living there. She didn't even know I was 15 or it would have been much bigger problems. And so at 15 years old, Just by picking up a clear gold liquid called tequila, I've jeopardized her right to have a break from those kids on the weekends. I've jeopardized their right to be able to see their father on the weekends. I've jeopardized his ability to interact in their kids' lives, all because of the effect a clear gold liquid has on me. But I don't make those kinds of connections because I have no idea what an alcoholic is or that I'm suffering from alcoholism. But I know now I'm wearing my welcome out. So he gets this brilliant idea to have me take the GED exam. Do you guys all have that out here? Yeah, okay. And alcoholics always know about the GED exam. It's called the shortcut, right? Well, he knew I was a good test taker, so he had me sign up for the GED exam. Certainly wasn't an idea that originated in my head, but ladies, you know how it is, or maybe men too, when you're living with the flavor of the month and they're paying your bills, you'll go for whatever they tell you to do. So I sign up and I take this GED exam, and it was like 5 hours long, and it's a test that has a subset of five categories, and if you score a certain percent in each of the five subtests, it's equal to a high school diploma. And I'm only 15, like I've only been to high school like, you know, a very short period of time. And about 3 weeks later, we received notification that indeed I passed that GED exam. You actually had to be 16 to take it, so I think I took it 1 week after my 16th birthday. So I received notification that I passed that GED exam, and I said, okay, I hope he's happy. And then he said, well, now you got a high school diploma, and he marched me down to a local community college, and it turns out his friend was the coach of that tennis team, and he had me try out for their tennis team, and I was good enough to play number two varsity string. And then he just, like, walked me straight across the path to admissions and records and enrolled me in 12 units with the hope that I would be in school all day and stay out of his hair. And then I'd be on that tennis team and traveling all weekend so that he could just get his kids back, because he's got a huge monkey on his back. He's got a 15-year-old girl living with him. So I did what they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. My living place is jeopardized. I don't want to go to the courts. I don't want to go into foster home. So I'm going to keep the flavor of the month happy. So I do what they talk about in the book. It says many of us swear off alcohol, either with or without a solemn oath. It goes on to say that we have these special skills, aptitudes, and abilities that we can not only build a bright outlook for ourselves, but we can also build a bright outlook for our loved ones. And then we pull the whole thing down over our head with a senseless series of sprees. Well, I'm like 16. I don't really see that pattern in my life yet, but boy, it sure shows up later, right? So I swear off alcohol with a solemn oath. I'm never going to drink again. And besides, I'm at my best when I'm in an academic athletic arena. So I go to that school, and for 2 years, I was on the dean's list all four semesters, and I could not get a B. I had to get an A, and I played on that tennis team, and I went, and I had to have brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast, and I went to a local beauty supplies, and I went expensive emollients and conditioners for my hair, and boy, I shaved my legs, and I painted my toenails, and I worked out, and I made awards on that tennis team, and I had to get a B. I couldn't get an A, because that's the structure that I have to impose upon myself to keep bad girl Tammy away. Because, see, bad girl Tammy's always chasing me, and I'm trying to outrun bad girl Tammy by changing the outsides. I don't understand that bad girl Tammy is on the inside and that I have to change my insides. So I do that game that so many of us do, and I start the running. Well, as usual, none of us can substantiate that, right? And so at 18 years old, I graduate, and I receive something called the Chancellor's Award. And that Chancellor's Award afforded me an opportunity to go to any one of five state universities in California, and they gave me the list, and I could pick any one of the five I wanted to go to. And for 2 more years, they would pay my tuition, my housing, my textbook, and my living expenses, and all I had to do was take 12 units or more and play on their tennis team. And guess what I did, guys? There's my alcoholic. Yeah, I quit. Are you kidding me? I was flipping exhausted. I was 18 years old, and I knew there was no way. I intuitively knew. At a deep level, I could not keep up that structure and discipline to outrun that monkey that keeps chasing me on that craziness that lives inside of me. To heck with it, I quit. But what I need to mention is I picked up a drink 2 times in those years that I was at that junior college, just 2 times from 16 to 18. And both times, because I'm an alcoholic that's never mildly intoxicated, I'm always more or less insanely drunk, both times I got arrested for public drunkenness. And because I'm an Orange Kid folder, they realized I was a runaway and I was a ward of the state. So both times they put me in an adolescent lockdown facility. And both times I went in there, and I went in there screaming and trying to fight cops. And within sobering up 24 hours, I sat with my pumpkin folder telling the therapist about my childhood and the abuse. And the diagnosis was always changed to emotional and mental disorders, trauma due to childhood, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And those doctors did what they do. They treated me for depression, anxiety, and insomnia. which, by the way, are symptoms of acute alcoholism. And they gave me antidepressants because I could not handle life on life's terms. They gave me things for anxiety because I couldn't handle things on life's terms. And they gave me stuff to sleep because I could not sleep. And nothing ever got better. Nothing ever got better. And so then all of a sudden, I'm 18 years old, and I decide I'm not going to do school. And it's like, you know, when you're on good behavior for prescribed amounts of times, and all of a sudden your brain says, you don't have to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, if you got blonde hair, blue eyes, tan skin, white teeth, and a really good tennis game, back in L.A. in the 80s, you did pretty well in a place called the Marina. And the Marina is a place where they have yachts and boats and big tennis clubs. So I decided to go down to the Marina, and I'm playing up pickup games at these rich, fancy tennis clubs. And these older men are, you know, playing with me. And, you know, I'm still living with that guy. You know how it is. I'm living with him, but playing footsies with all these other men that are giving me attention. You know, I mean, me living with him, that is just an incidental. You know how we roll, right? And for 2 years, I'm doing that deal. And they were all so impressed that this little girl could have such a good tennis game. But all of a sudden, I got arrested for a felony DUI, and I'm thrown in jail. And, of course, I call that boyfriend, and he bails me out one more time and lets me come live in his condominium with him. And now his kids are getting a little older. And I realized, you know, that I can't be a competitive tennis player anymore because those years are gone. So I decide instead I'm going to reinvent myself now as a triathlete. So I go to the local health food store, and I want brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast. And I go to the local beauty supply, and I want expensive emollients and conditioners for my hair. And I get a mountain bike, and I'm training on my mountain bike, and I'm swimming laps, and I'm lifting weights at the gym. And I decide that I do my best in an academic arena, so I go off to Cal State University, Northridge in Los Angeles, and I thought maybe the 12 units wasn't enough, so this time I'm going for 15. And for the next couple of months, I'm, you know, eating brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast and shaving my legs and conditioning my hair, and I'm working out and doing the same thing that I had done several years earlier, expecting different results, thinking maybe this time I can outrun that monkey on my back. And during this time, this man moved right next door to that boyfriend that I was living with, Dennis and I. There was literally like one wall that separated our condominium unit from his. And as he's moving in, he's this tall, handsome guy, and I find out from the women in the building that he's an OBGYN. This is the guy that later went on to be my husband. And he's moving in, and I notice he has a triathlete shirt on. And I'm like, hey, you know, are you a triathlete? And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, I am too. And he said, yeah, I've just moved here, and I've just gotten out of a 10-year marriage. And I'm like, ding, 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 right? And the next day, he and I are running. You know, at 6 in the morning, we're running 2 miles together, and then I'm taking him down to my gym, and I enroll him in my gym, and he's spotting me on weights. And the following Wednesday, we're laying out by the pool because he had Wednesdays off his medical practice, and I was taking a microbiology and physiology class, and he's helping with my homework. And again, the fact that I'm living, like, right next door to him with another man, that's just an incidental. You know how we roll, right? But poor old Rick met me in a swearing-off period. And I was academic and athletic, you know, kind of shy, coy Tammy. And he really became infatuated with me. And one night, Dennis came home, and he and I got into kamikazes. And we did some shooters at kamikazes. And the next thing I know, we're getting in one of those knockdown, drag-out physical fights that we can get into. And it became so loud that neighbor Dr. Rick had to call the police. So the police show up to our condominium, and I see my boyfriend Dennis talking to the police, and there's Dr. Rick going, you know, is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay? And I'm just sitting on the couch drunk. And we finally got rid of the police, and we got rid of Dr. Rick, and then, you know, Dennis and I went upstairs and did one of those all-night, you know, passionate makeups that we do after we've beaten the crap out of each other, and the police show up like, you're my soulmate, I love you. Because we're so dramatic and we're so extreme. And he and I professed our love to each other all night like a bad Hallmark card. But I woke up the next day and I did exactly what's described in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That after a while, a drinking alcoholic cannot separate the true from the false. That after a while, the only life a drinking alcoholic comes to understand is their drinking life. And I literally thought nothing the next morning of waking up, taking a little liquid makeup, covering up the black eyes and the choke marks from the night before, putting a backpack on my back and going off to Cal State University, Northridge. Like, there's literally nothing wrong with this picture. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm pulling into the subterranean parking of that condominium complex. Now, I've been drinking the night before, so I'm hungover. I haven't slept all night because we professed our love to each other like a bad Hallmark card. I have been beaten up the night before, and let's be fair, ladies, I beat the crap out of him, too. They used to call me Tammy Tyson when I drank, because I'm a violent little guy. And so my whole body was physically in pain. I'd been sitting in classes all day long till 2:30. And I park my car and I'm walking toward the elevator and my jaw is tight, my back is rigid, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm tightly wound, and everything hurts. And I'm walking toward the elevator and a thought occurs to me. Wait, I'm home and there's a huge bottle of vodka waiting for me upstairs. Now, I haven't seen that vodka, I haven't smelled the vodka, I certainly haven't tasted the vodka, but thinking about a clear liquid like the water in his water bottle, just thinking about it, my jaw starts to relax, my back loosens up, I'm a walking, like, you know, here it comes, right? And I get in the elevator, and you know what, if you identify with that, you're probably an alcoholic, right? Because clear liquids, like, really do not have that kind of a voice and a pull on somebody. And I get in the elevator, and I turn to hit the closed door button, and there's Dr. Rick right at the doors. You know, the one that calls the police on you the night before and they're going to ask you those questions you can't answer. So I'm like pushing the closed door button and his hand wedged between those doors. And he walks into the elevator and he stares at me, which is like the worst thing you could do to me. I feel like you're just eating my soul with your eyes. And he says, you know, so I'm like doing this stuff, you know. And then he says, you know, you and I need to talk about what happened last night. And prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and having a good sponsor like Clancy, I used to use a tremendous amount of foul language. I used to cuss like a drunken sailor, and I used to use a tremendous amount of inappropriate sexual humor, sexual attire, and sexual body language to keep especially you men like a little bit off your footing with me so you can never just look me in the eye and have an adult conversation with me. So I'm in the elevator and I'm feeling uncomfortable, so I pull out tough cussing bratitude. I'm like, you effing know what went down last night. You know, you're the one that called the effing cops on me and I've been up all night and I don't want to effing talk about it. And instead of him going on the defense, he quietly just put his hands on my shoulders. And that really disarmed me because I'm not used to that kind of a response. So I quickly realized, like, okay, the tough, cussing, brash woman isn't going to, like, put him off his game. So I pull out the seductress, and he had a beautiful suit and a silk fascinal tie. And I just grabbed his tie, and I yanked his neck right into my nose, and I nuzzled his neck, and I said, my God, your cologne, you all smell so delicious. And he stepped back, and he took my chin, and he held it so I couldn't wiggle away. And Rick looked right down and to my eyes with those beautiful brown eyes of his, and he said, Tammy, he says, I've really come to care for you, and you're such an enterprising, engaging, intelligent woman, and I could really tell you're struggling with something, and I want to help you, but I don't know what's wrong with you. And that's the worst thing you can hear if you're an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism and you don't know it. Because at this point in my life, I have now had 10 years of therapy. I've been in and out of lockdown mental facilities. I've been on antidepressants, all kinds of medications. And the doctors have told me that I cannot have survived 10 years of abuse from 5 to 15 at the hand of my father and in any way be wired or be normal. And so I know I'm a mental defect, and my job now at 25 years old is to just fake it till I make it and pretend that I'm okay so none of you guys know how scared I am that I know that something's wrong with me. But for whatever reason, and today I know it's the grace of God, I got off that elevator and I went into Rick's condominium unit and I told him the cry of every alcoholic. For the first time, I wasn't one that talked about my childhood. I just pretended it didn't happen. And everyone knew, and my sisters would talk about it, but I hated it when they would go to therapy and talk about it because I just did not want to talk about it. But I went in that apartment of his or that condominium, and I told him about my dad. And I told him about the abuse. And I told him one day I am going to finish my college education. And one day when I finish my education, I'm going to get a job. And one day when I have a job, I'm not going to live with abusive men. And one day and one day and one day, because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is like, look, I know my life looks a little whack right now, but I have a plan. And when my plan comes to fruition, it's all going to be okay. And if you're in this room tonight, and you don't understand why the old-timers are laughing at your plan, every alcoholic has a plan. It's never a good plan. And the book tells you that no human power, not your mommy, not your daddy, not your therapist, not your kids, not even your sponsor, can save you from alcoholism, but God can and he will if you seek him. It doesn't say God should or he might. It says God can and he will. But I don't know to seek spiritual help because I don't understand that I'm suffering from a spiritual malady. I think I'm suffering from a psychological medical malady. And I keep doing what most alcoholics do. We go to the medical doctors to treat the way we feel, and we go to psychiatrists to treat the way we think. But in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says when the spiritual malady is overcome, the mental and the physical straighten out. But I'm trying to straighten out the mental and the physical to cure a spiritual malady that I don't even know I have. So I tell him that day that about my dad and stuff, but for the first time in 25 years, I actually cried like the broken kid I was and always had been. No more tough cussing Tammy. No more sexual seductress Tammy. I actually just cried like a broken little girl. And he held me and I let him hold me. And I went home that night and I never did get that drink of vodka that I'd been thinking about. And I slept for the first time in a long time without drinking myself to sleep. But I woke up the next morning and I felt the fear that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Because another human being saw the broken truth about me. And I am now, like the book says, constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself about the role that alcohol is playing in my life, and more importantly, the role that alcohol is playing in the lives of anybody that is interacting with me. And I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't have a higher power that I could pray to and ask for strength. And I didn't have a friend like Kathy that I could just call up and say, Kathy, can you meet me at the local meeting? I just want to talk those dumb women fears through with. And I did the only thing that I've ever gone to, the only higher power I ever knew to take away the pain. And I poured myself a drink of vodka that morning that I didn't take the night before at 9 a.m. Once the alcohol took effect, I came up with a plan. And my plan was that I'd been with Dennis now for going on over 9 years, and things weren't going really well with he and I. But that rich surgeon next door, I could tell he really had a crush on me. And I had the key to his condominium unit because I used to take care of his exotic plants when he traveled to medical conventions. And my plan that morning was to just take all my stuff out of Dennis's condo and move it into Rick's. And seriously, this is the honest-to-God plan. I needed to get Rick between the sheets and replace the broken image I saw of me reflected in his eyes the night before and the pity that he looked at me with, and replace it with Tammy, the sexual goddess. So I spent the day drunk moving. Are there any Al-Anons in the room tonight? You'll get this. They won't. Dennis came home that afternoon, and there I weren't. Rick came home that afternoon, and there I were. And mind you, there was one wall that separated us. And that's how callous and disrespectful I am for anybody's feelings about anything. But Al-Anons, I want you to know that not only did he let me stay, but 3 weeks later, Rick walked me down the aisle and he said, I do. And that was the day that he qualified for Al-Anon because his life was the same after that. And you know, I'm going to tell you that it's taken me a long time to get to this place where I can say this from a podium, but I punished Rick for everything that my father had ever done to me. I punished Rick for a crime he never even committed. My ex-husband also grew up in a horribly abusive alcoholic home, and he survived that home. He was academically brilliant, and he was so brilliant that he ended up going to high school at 12. He made it to college at 16, he made it to medical school at 20, and at 24 years old, he was an air flight surgeon in the Vietnam War, sewing our boys' bodies back at the tail end of the war when they were being medevaced off the field, and he survived that war and a 10-year marriage. And just being married to me for a couple of months, he was stuttering and stammering and didn't even know his own shadow, because I'm not a funny drunk. I emasculated him, I humiliated him. And I think it's important that we share some of that stuff on the podium, because his only crime was he was trying to help somebody, and I punished him for the crime that he never even committed. And because he was pre-Al-Anon and pre-a program of recovery for himself, he stoutly co-signed that and stood in there for the butt kicking, and I darn near destroyed his soul. That marriage produced two children, and today I have a daughter, Chelsea, that's 31, and I have a son, Alex, that's 30, and through the grace of God, I was so physically sick when I was pregnant with both my children. I had a condition called hyperemesis. I couldn't stand the smell of perfume. I couldn't stand the smell of cut flowers. I couldn't stand the smell of coffee. I couldn't stand the smell of alcohol. And so I went an entire 9 months pregnant with my daughter, and I couldn't even touch a drink. 6 weeks after I gave birth to my daughter, I am now in a 4,000-square-foot home. I got a four-car garage, and all the cars are paid for. I'm married to a prominent surgeon in the area. And I then find out 6 weeks later that my breast milk dried up because I'm pregnant again with my son. My ex-husband hates me sharing that. He's an OBGYN. You're supposed to, like, wait a little longer. And I went another 9 months straight without picking up a drink. I woke up one morning, and I have a one-year-old little girl that I love with all my heart and soul. And I have this brand-new baby boy, and all of a sudden I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got these two living human beings looking at me for something, and I'm so painfully aware deep inside that I'm a completely crippled human being, and I can't handle this life of a surgeon's wife. And nowadays, a lot of surgeons are married to, like, other doctors, so we're going to parties, and all the women are anesthesiologists or doctors, and there's me. Yeah, I dropped out of school at 15, and I'm feeling really insecure and really inadequate, and I went down to the liquor store and I picked up a drink after 2 years, and it was on. And the book says that many women cross beyond recognition in a short period of time, and that certainly was my story. And I became a daily drinker with these two little kids. And you want to talk about hard work, man. Try being a mom and an active alcoholic. And I start drinking, and my husband's coming home and realizing that I'm not doing well, so he's pre-Al-Anon, and he gets a brilliant idea. I'm going to hire a full-time housekeeper to stay home and take care of Tammy in the house, and he's going to ship our two little kids out to full-time daycare because he's, you know, delivering babies all night long and making rounds at the hospital. So I don't work. I don't go to school. I have someone paying my bills, someone taking care of my kids, someone taking care of my house. That's suicide if you're an alcoholic of my type. And I spin down pretty badly. One afternoon, I don't know why, and I hear all these speakers with these, like, amazing, fabulous stories and SWAT teams and police chases. I'm going to be straight up with you, man. 99% of my drinking was really pathetic and uneventful and just really tragic. But this was my highlight. Back then, I was into getting a tan, and we had this beautiful pool in, like, this three-story house, and in the middle story was this big balcony, and I remember one morning being drunk and looking down at the pool and looking up at the roof, and I determined that the roof is closer to the sun than the pool. So I get this big extension ladder, and I shimmy up there with my bikini and my tumbler of vodka, and I'm greased up in baby oil like a little pig laying on my roof suntanning. And Rick picks the kids up from daycare half a day to bring them home to the housekeeper for the rest of the day because they're tiny little things. I really messed that up. I'm sorry. Leave it to me to screw something up. Thank you, sir. There we go.
No, that's not helping at all.
Yeah, the little one on the right. There you go.
Are you Al-Anon?
Right.
Just a very sober alcoholic, right? Anyway. And they pull in the cul-de-sac, and there's Mom, like, on the roof, you know, in a bikini, and wild and drunk. And he parks the car in the garage, and he walks out, and Chelsea was 3, and Alex was 2. And they look up at me, and I don't know why. I remember doing it, but I walked to the edge of that third-story roof, and I just jumped off onto my husband's head, and I'm digging my nails in his head, and he's spinning, and the kids are screaming, and the neighbors come out, and the next day, I'm in jail in a lockdown facility, and again, I have no recollection of what happened or why I do what I do, but the very next night, my husband found a group of people called Al-Anon, and I am not an alcoholic that takes kindly to Al-Anon jokes. I'm not an Al-Anon. I don't go to Al-Anon, but Al-Anon saved my family, and they probably were the ones that pushed my hand to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he starts going to meetings with women that don't cuss like drunken sailors. He goes to meetings with women that don't dress like two-bit whores. He goes to meetings with women that work and contribute to the family income. He goes to meetings with women that take care of their family and their kids. Is it any wonder that I feel the fear they talk about in this book when my husband starts going to these meetings? So I call it the, oh, you're going to go to your let's all feel sorry for Dr. Rick Harum, and they're going to dance around you about how sad it is that you're married to me. Because we have to put down anything that jeopardizes our control over keeping our life the way it is. And he goes to these Al-Anon meetings, and about 6 weeks later, he comes home, and I'm sitting on the stairs drunk just waiting for him to come home from that meeting. And he said, Tammy, you can go to a hell in a handbasket if you want to, but you won't take the kids and I with you anymore. And I knew there was no fight that night. There was a peace in him, and there was a resolve, and there was something in his eyes, and I knew those Al-Anons were giving him a backbone to stand up to the insidiousness of my alcoholism. And I felt the fear they talked about in this book, and I picked a fight as quickly as I could. He didn't even engage. So I grabbed my keys, because now my arms are too short to box with God, right? And I go to the liquor store, and I buy some vodka, and I get up on the freeway, and the vodka took effect, and I saw a call box on the freeway, and I thought it was a payphone. And the next thing I know, I wipe my BMW into this call box, and 30 days later, I'm standing in front of a woman judge. And she looks at my rap sheet, and she says, you know, Tammy, your rich doctor husband isn't going to buy you out of this time. I've been in two lockdown units from 16 to 18, never once for the diagnosis of alcoholism, but both times I'm put in those lockdown adolescent wards because of the effect that alcohol is having on me and the subsequent behaviors. When my daughter was 3 years old, I was in a lockdown facility, and my husband and family wouldn't come to the multifamily specialty group where they all come and sit and talk about me and my pain. And I was angry, so when I got out of the lockdown facility, I took a whole bottle of antidepressants, and then I felt my heart start to palpitate and my head float off, and I got scared. So I called 911, and I handed the phone to my 4-year-old daughter to get the paramedics. And they put me in a lockdown facility for 42 days on that suicide attempt. And now I'm in this lockdown facility, now I'm in jail, and she tells me that she's going to waive part of my sentence and put me in another lockdown facility. And I go into that lockdown facility, and I tell those doctors what I've been telling them since I was 15 years old about my drinking, and they told me that I'm clinically depressed as a result of my childhood. The best hope for me is the right medical combination of medications so that I don't have to continually self-medicate with alcohol, but none of these actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, old-timers like Patrick had a new name for the effect that alcohol appeared to have on me, as written word for word in the doctor's opinion of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they suggested that I may be an alcoholic. In that lockdown facility, I told those doctors that I'd wake up out of a blackout, I'd go downstairs, I'd see broken glass, broken children, a broken husband, a broken home. I'd just go back upstairs, turn the heating blanket up to mom, suck my thumb, and think of ways to kill myself. And I had that feeble attempt at suicide that landed me in a lockdown for over a month and a half. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that I'm going to need to be treated for episodic depression and ongoing therapy because of the length of the abuse I faced as a kid, and having the right combination of medications that will have to be switched out from time to time. But none of these actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, old-timers like Clancy had a new name for a mother that attempted to take her life in front of her 4-year-old without giving a crap how it would affect that little girl or my son, my husband, or my mom. He called it alcoholism, selfishness, self-centeredness. The world revolved around my childhood pain. Forget I got two little kids in their childhood. I'm still going on and on about mine. In that lockdown facility, I told those doctors that I used to steal money out of my husband's wallet and take his credit card. And I'd go to the local gym, work out with all you men, of course. And then I'd take all you men up to the pub after, buy drinks on my husband's dime, always playing the big shot, taking credit for money I didn't even earn. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that taking my husband's money to get affection and attention from men was really my way indirectly of getting back that attention I'd been so poorly robbed of in my childhood. So none of those actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers had a new name for that behavior, too. They called it stealing. And not only did I steal my husband's hard-earned money and play big shot on his dime, but I used to go to those local daytime motels with other men that I met at the gym while I was married to a hard-working husband and had two beautiful children at home. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that my dad gave me a script when I was 5 years old that my only worth was my sexuality. And all I was doing in those
hotels, was acting out a script that I'd been so poorly given in my childhood, but none of those actions in those daytime motel rooms were really my fault. And for a buck in the basket, the old timers had a name for that too. They called it cheating. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my mom and husband had had me in 4 lockdown facilities at the tune back then, this is like 27 years ago, of $100,000 to find out that living inside of me was this hurt, wounded child from this discontented childhood, and none of the actions in my adult life were really my fault. And for a buck in a basket, the old timers in AA said, "No, kid, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, and you're just an alcoholic, probably suffering from alcoholism." And God, I needed it to be so much more. The condition of my getting out of that lockdown facility is I have to start attending AA meetings. I come to meetings late. I leave meetings early. I wear low-cut tops, little Daisy Duke shorts. I spend most of my time out on the smoke break talking to you men. I took 5 of those 30-day chips. I'll never forget my last chip because I stood at a podium and I told them all about God and how wonderful my life was. But what I didn't mention is that Al-Anon rightly convinced my husband that he is 100% responsible if I drive and kill those kids in a car wreck, because Tammy is not capable of making a sober decision, and that it was his responsibility as the sober person to make a responsible decision for the safety of his minor children. And what I didn't tell y'all is my mother, my sister, and my ex-husband had gone down to court and gotten legal custody, temporary custody of my kids, and because they had to set court dates and couldn't do it right away, he just kidnapped my kids one night and took them out and was living in a one-bedroom apartment, working the hours that he worked, trying to take care of our kids. But I didn't tell you all that in Alcoholics Anonymous while I'm in and out getting my chips, because I was enjoying a break from being married. I was enjoying a little break from being a mom, and I was really enjoying the attention I was getting from the men in AA. And I got down off the podium, and I took my chip and went right out to flirt with the men outside. And this mean old-timer, Cowboy Nick, walked out, and he said, "Kid, you have a phone call." And I picked up the phone in the clubhouse, and it was my husband, Rick. I hadn't seen my husband or children in 67 days. That's 2 months and a week. And I picked up the phone, and he asked me if I was sober, and with the arrogance of an alcoholic, I said, "Yeah, Rick, I'm sober. In fact, hey, I've taken another 30-day chip." He said, "Tammy," he said, "our son is having night terrors every night. I had to take him to a pediatric psychiatrist who has asked me to sign him up for T-ball to get his little 5-year-old mind off his troubles. Chelsea cannot make it through a half a day at kindergarten without going in the nurse's office being doubled over with stomach aches, and she cries every night for her mom. So I've signed up Alex for T-ball, and as much as I don't want to see you, woman, if you're sober, I think it's important that the children see you. They're not doing well." I got the directions and I drove out to that little league field. And as I started to walk toward the field, my husband, raising our kids out of a one-bedroom hotel room, trying to practice medicine 80 hours a week, was there with a man from Al-Anon in a team uniform, and he was the assistant coach of my son's team. My little daughter was in the most beautiful pinafore sundress, and her hair was back in a French braid. And I later found out that the women in Al-Anon were helping my kids with their little kindergarten homework and their little packing their little lunches and getting them clothes, because I was busy getting attention from the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my little 5-year-old son came out of the dugout, and he had this little batting helmet on with these little cleats and these little pants. And I looked at my family, and I just walked away. And I found a guy with a big cooler of beer in front of him, and I took a beer from him. 3 days later, they found me 45 minutes away from my home down by the LAX airport. To this day, 25 years later, I have absolutely no recollection of what happened in those 3 days. They found my car at the Little League field. During that time, my husband moved back into our home, and he said he's not going to raise the kids in a hotel room anymore. And I'm struck sober sitting in some woman's kitchen holding an ice pack on the side of my face. She found me in an alley behind her house, and she's giving Rick directions to pick me up for the last time. Rick got me in the car, and he handed me a manila envelope, and he said, "Tammy," he said, "your mother, your sister, and I were awarded temporary legal custody yesterday at family court at 11:30 a.m. You cannot come within 100 yards of our home, of my medical practice, of the children's school, of their daycare, and you need to leave." And he didn't say another word the whole way home. He pulled up and he turned off the engine in front of our house. He didn't even pull into the driveway. And he said, "Tammy, please call one of your AA bimboy boyfriends to come and pick you up. And I promise you, I will send you all your stuff when you find somewhere to live. and I will send you money every month. But for God's sakes, just leave me and the children alone. And I want you to know that I walked up the stairs of that house, and I was literally a walking dead person. It's like my body was moving, but I just remember feeling no emotions, nothing. And I remember this buzzing in my ears. And I was literally spiritually dead. And I went in the master bedroom, and I took some gym clothes, and I threw them in my gym bag. And as I walked out of the bedroom, Rick was leaning against the door jamb, looking down. And I said, Rick, I know I need to go, and I wanted to go. I wanted to go. I was so tired. I knew I was hurting them. I knew I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I said, but can I just please say goodbye to Chelsea and Alex before I leave? And he said, Tammy, your kids have been through hell and back the last 3 days. He said, they're asleep in their bedrooms. And for once in your life, Tammy, please, you can look in on them, but don't wake your children. And I want you to know that that was on April 23rd, 1994, three. And I stood outside my son Alex's room, and as I opened the door, the hall light went right down onto my little son Alex's face. And he was asleep in this big, huge pine bunk bed. And I'm always so ashamed to share this, but I saw my son. The way a mother is supposed to see her child, I saw him. I saw him, and he was so alive, and he was so little, and I was mesmerized, and he looked just like his father, and he was so beautiful, and I'd been his mom for 5 years, and I'd never really seen his little soul. And I walked up to him, and I sat on the bed, and I reeked of alcohol, and my five-year-old asked me a question that all you well-meaning AAs, all those therapists, my mom, my husband, my sister, and my little boy looked at me and he said, Mommy, when are you going to quit going away and just stay home and be with us? And in that instant, I became willing to do whatever it took. I never wanted to drink alcohol again. And I know it like I'm standing here tonight. It wasn't my childhood. It wasn't the abuse. Everything that went wrong in my life is over a clear liquid. And if you're in this room tonight, and you have grandparents or parents or brothers or sisters or cousins, a husband, a wife, for God's sakes, a child that has cried more than, listen to me, 2 times, not 1,000 times, that has cried more than 2 times over your drinking, then like me and like this book tells you, you're a selfish, self-centered human being. There's no shame in being an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to hurt the very people I love the most. The shame is that you got a book and a room full of people here that will show you that you never, ever have to pick up a drink again if you don't want to. And even if you do want to, we'll show you how you don't have to pick up that drink. And for whatever reason, I surrendered my right to drink alcohol to God and Alcoholics Anonymous that night in my son's room. And I have never picked up a drink since. I ended up having to stay on a couch for 8 months. When I first got sober, I had lost custody of my children. We don't promise you back your children here, but if you're estranged from any family members, you got a heck of a better chance of being in their lives if you're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 8 months of sobriety, I received my custody of my kids back, and through the grace of God and Al-Anon, my husband decided to come and give me another chance as a sober wife. I went on to be his wife for another 12 years. My ex-husband made a fatal Al-Anon mistake. When I had 8 years of sobriety, I'm active, and I'm a mom, and I'm going to school, and I'm everything that he ever wanted. And unfortunately, he thought his problem was cured, and he quit going to Al-Anon. By the time I had 12 years of sobriety, he said to me, Tammy, I've met another woman. She's younger than you. She's prettier than you, and she's a heck of a lot more fun than you. Because, see, I'm attracted to alcohol, and he's attracted to the chaos of an alcoholic. And I'd just gotten a little too unfun. And I ended up having to walk through a painful divorce that I did not want to go through. And like I said, I had to inventory that. And I was so active and obsessed in AA, I never really did make him feel like he was number one. And that's on me. I was able to get custody back of my kids. I remember when you're sober, saying to Clancy, you know, I'm sober and I'm going back to school and I just signed up for 15 units. And he's like, good asshole, now go drop 11 of them. He said, we know you know how to go to school, Tammy, but you don't know how to go to school sober.
And you're going to take so many units that you're going to miss. Oh, I can't come to the meeting. I have to study. Oh, I can't come to the meeting. I got finals, so I can't come to the meeting. He goes, you want to go to school? Go to school. But you got to be able to go to school sober, and meeting makers make it. So you are not going to go to school or get a job or do anything. It starts with your meetings, and you gear your life around your meetings, not your meetings around your life. And I've been raised like that since day one, and I can't tell you how many women I've sponsored that got their life back at 1, 2, or 3 years sober. I'm going to school, and off they go, and they come back, and they don't get the education, and they lose their sobriety. So I'm grateful to him for that. Look, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years. It took me 18 flipping years. But I was a high school dropout, man, and I stand before you. I not only have one, I have 2 master's degrees. And wait, check it out, in English education. And I came in here cussing like a drunken sailor. I couldn't even, you know, Clancy used to say, do you eat with that filthy mouth? He goes, you speak with crippled language. Why don't you talk like an adult? And you know what? I teach your kids, man. I teach your grandkids. If that doesn't scare you, it seriously should, right? And I went through that painful divorce, and anyway, four years ago, sadly, my husband was suffering the effects of Agent Orange, and he was doing a surgery, and he started to complain of back pain, and he collapsed. He said, I need to go home, so he scrubbed out, stabilized the patient, the other surgeon finished it, but he had passed a kidney stone like 4 months earlier, so he thought it was another kidney stone. So he went home and apparently collapsed at home and never even made it, you know, to his bed. And then he didn't show up for work the following Monday. He had off, so this was like on a Thursday. So Friday he didn't show up. Saturday, Sunday was the weekend. Monday he was off work. By Tuesday he didn't show up to work. My ex-husband has not missed a day of work in 40 years. So they immediately called my daughter, who was next to kin, and she called me and said, Mommy, Daddy didn't show up to work. I said, Chelsea, something's wrong. So she gave them permission, and they went to where he lived, and they saw the lights were on, his car was there, and no answer. So Chelsea gave permission for the management company to go in, and they found him on the floor, and they immediately rushed him to the hospital, and they called me, and they told me they could keep him alive long enough just to say goodbye to his children. And he had full-blood septicemia and was in complete organ failure. So Patrick and I and the kids drove the 3 hours to where he was living, and I walk into this intensive care room, and there's this man that saved me in every way that a woman could be saved. And I'm looking at him completely unconscious, hooked up to all these machines. And I had to walk my daughter and son in to say goodbye to their father. My daughter was the most painful because she was engaged to be married. And she said, Daddy, you were supposed to walk me down the aisle, and nobody could do that but you. And Clancy told me, you know, you put on your big girl panties and be a strong woman for those children, because this is happening to them, and that's their father. And we went through that, and when it was over, I asked the doctors if I could just stay with him until he passed. I didn't want him to be alone, and because he was a surgeon on staff, they allowed that. And Patrick and I put on our little hazmat suits because he was septic, and we stood at his bedside, and I held his hand, and I thanked him for saving me in every way that a woman could be saved. And Patrick whispered in his ear, and he said, hey, buddy, take an Emmy and go on home for a life well lived. And I promise you, I will never let any harm come to Tammy or your children. And my husband and I had become best friends at that point, because during our divorce, I was entitled to half of his $1 million medical practice and $4,300 a month. And Clancy said, I didn't go to medical school. I'm not a goddamn doctor. I don't deserve a medical practice. And that Rick had put me through school and put me back on my feet, so he didn't feel that I deserved any alimony or spousal support. And I went back and called off my attorney and told my husband I didn't want any money and thanked him for putting me through college. And my husband never truly believed that someone could really change. And he told me that when I did that, he truly believed that I was a different person. And so we become very close friends. He left me for that other woman, and of course she took him for every penny he had and then left him, and it turns out she was a worse alcoholic than I was, if you can imagine. And he's back in Al-Anon anyway. But I just want you to know that that night I stood and I looked at him, and it was like time stood completely still. And I want you to know that Rick didn't die that night, and he didn't die the next morning. 15 days later, they took him off life support, and he started to breathe on his own. 5 months later, they called us, and they said, he is viable with life, but he'll never walk or talk again. But we can do no more for him here, and we needed to find a long-term board and care facility until the good Lord took him or whatever was going to happen.
And I looked at Patrick and I was devastated. And I'm looking at these boarding care facilities and this beautiful man, this triathlete, this accomplished surgeon, is now going to live in a bed, in a room, three beds stacked high, and his whole life is reduced to a twin bed and a dresser. And I couldn't do it. And I called Clancy and I said, Clancy, what do you do when none of your options work? And he said, Tammy, you do the next indicated thing and you find him a place near you and you check in and you make sure he's getting the care he needs. But this is bigger than you. And I went, and he said, and Tammy, sometimes you just got to pray and the answers will come. And by the way, go to work. Clancy's always, you never miss work. So I go to work crying that day and I come home and my cul-de-sac is filled with Patrick's construction trucks. My husband's a contractor. And my husband and his guys gutted the downstairs bedroom and they put in floors and pulleys and we ordered a $6,000 hospital bed and we made special showers. And we got to bring Rick home. And we just said, you know what, we're going to do the best we can. And we hired in caregivers. My ex-husband walked my daughter down the aisle on 2015, and he did the father-daughter dance. And that's what recovery looks like in AA and Al-Anon. The minute he got home and had the love of a good ex-wife, Patrick's good cooking, and his children around him, he started to thrive. And they don't know this man, but I had a baby monitor in his room because we were upstairs and Rick was downstairs. And Patrick would go in and talk to him. And if you talk to my husband, he's got like a strong Irish brogue. And I'd hear Rick say, Patrick, man, you have got to call Nurse Ratchet off, man. She makes me get up every day and shower, and I have to shave, and I'm so weak. And Patrick's like, aye, man. He goes, you better get up and learn how to walk again. He goes, if you're ever going to escape her. And I didn't sleep in that long. All right, like, anyway, so my daughter went on to graduate UCLA with honors, and my daughter isn't tatted up, and she's not, doesn't cuss like a drunken sailor, and she doesn't dress like a two-bit whore. She's an intelligent, articulate, feminine young lady. She married a beautiful guy, and today I have this brand-new, beautiful grandson named Rourke, and I could have missed it all. My son was going to go to medical school like his dad, and he started to post some really weird things on Facebook, and we were concerned. And then my daughter called me, and some of her friends called and said, Mom, something's wrong with Alex. And we're like, is he on drugs, or what's going on? And we called for a welfare check, and they said he's over the age of 18. So finally my ex-husband called, and he said, man, I'm not calling as his dad. I'm calling as a doctor. And they found my son in complete psychosis. We brought him home, and we put him in the hospital. And 3 years ago, my son, my beautiful son, was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And I've seen things with that illness that no mother should have to see. While he was inpatient, this girl shows up at our door, 9 months pregnant, and says that my son is the father of her child. And I'm like, it ain't hell. It's not hot. This is not happening. But thank God for Clancy, because I'm sucking my thumb crying. He goes, God damn it, Tammy, this isn't happening to you. It's happening to him. And he said, and the sooner you can accept the fact that your child has schizophrenia, he goes, Tammy, acceptance is agreeing to what already is. Now, you put on your big girl panties, and how do you know that God didn't bless you with sobriety? At the time, I think I had 22 years sober. He said, so that you could be the mother that that boy is going to need to take care of one of the most serious mental illnesses with no cure that's debilitating and progressive. And the minute Clancy said that, man, I snapped up. To make a long story short, I lost legal custody of my children 25 years ago, and the courts just determined that Patrick and I are the right people to adopt my little 3-year-old grandson, Matthew. It turned out that it was his baby. His girlfriend was not well enough to take care of the child. We had to go to court and get custody of him. So today, for a little girl that couldn't even show up for her own life, and by the way, my ex-husband still lives with us too. So we got, wait, check this out, man, because you're never going to hear this from me again. We got my 90-year-old mom, my ex-husband, my mentally disabled son, and we're raising a flipping 3-year-old man, and I'm 59, and he's 70, and we're freaking exhausted. And you know what I mean? I never had it so good. And that little guy has wormed his way into our hearts and souls. And you know what? Today I have hope for my future. I have hope for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have hope for my son, who is medication compliant, back in school, and he'll never be the same. But he's our Alex, and he's got a happy, productive life with us. And I'm grateful and have hope for that little guy. I thank God for AA. I thank AA for God, and I thank all of you. Thanks so much.